Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, joining you once again for the third installment in the JonBenet Ramsey series, in which we're going to indulge a deep analysis of the infamous ransom note, which has left interested parties divided regarding its origin. While some take the note at face value, meaning that a kidnapper seeking a hefty ransom payout from the wealthy Ramseys authored the note, others believe the words were penned in the context of a cover-up after a staged crime that was designed to conceal something sinister that occurred within the family itself, or even just an accident. Regardless of the truth, what law enforcement and the public were left with in the aftermath consisted of an incoherent criminal narrative, in the sense that the note told us that JonBenet had been kidnapped by a group of foreign individuals seeking a six-figure ransom, yet her dead body was discovered inside the home shortly thereafter, bound, strangled, and bludgeoned, seemingly as the result of a violent sexual assault by a sadistic predator who obviously left the home without the girl in tow. The first question we would need to ponder in this sequence of events is why, if the kidnappers wanted a ransom, they left JonBenet's body in the home. It's often cited by those in favor of the intruder theory that, quote-unquote, something went wrong during the sexual assault in the basement, such as JonBenet screaming or crying out in some way that would garner attention from those who were sleeping upstairs. Yet the autopsy would show that the blow to the head occurred prior to the strangulation by way of the garrote that ultimately killed the girl. If the intruder feared that those who were sleeping upstairs were awakened by his actions, and to the extent he needed to cause JonBenet's death to quiet her, why did he remain in the home with her and do so in a place, the wine cellar, that had no exterior windows and doors, leaving him trapped if anyone came down to check? So if something did indeed go wrong, and the kidnapper felt it was necessary to end the little girl's life so suddenly, instead of just silencing her with a hand over the mouth or similar, then why did he leave the body behind? If succeeding at acquiring a large sum of money from John Ramsey was the point of the kidnapping, and the people upstairs had no idea that JonBenet was dead until the next day when they found her, then why wouldn't the kidnapper/killer just take the body with him and continue to demand the ransom in the aftermath? If the Ramseys and police simply had no idea JonBenet was dead until they found her, and both parties behaved as though, and even explicitly stated, they were seeking someone who was alive and had been kidnapped until the point at which she was discovered dead, what would have precluded the perpetrator from following through? Why did the kidnapper or kidnappers betray the interests of the group he or they represented, when in fact, taking JonBenet's body with them when she was already dead in the family's and police's ignorance would have allowed them to continue with getting the ransom money they sought? We know by way of the strangulation happening a significant time after the blow to the head that the kidnapper did not freak out and flee from the home. Rather, that person remained there and proceeded to perform the supposed sadistic sexual assault by way of the garrote. Had anyone upstairs heard JonBenet scream in that moment that quote-unquote something went wrong, help would have long since arrived by the time the kidnapper actually left the home in the aftermath. So why was the body still there? Why was it not taken by the kidnapper in order to continue with the plan of collecting the ransom? While we can't answer that question definitively, what we can say is that the most likely reason JonBenet's body doesn't leave the home that night is because the person who delivered the blow to the head, along with the one who bound and strangled her, whether or not they were one and the same, also never left the home, which by default would mean they're members of the family. We have a ransom note claiming a kidnapping that never actually occurred, in the sense that the child remained in the home, and then also have the presence of a sexually sadistic crime in which there is no evidence, despite appearances, that a sexual act between the victim and the perpetrator ever occurred. So let's keep those elements in mind here. Now, it's the morning of December 26, 1996, and we've already discussed the events leading up to this day, in addition to what occurred at the time of the 911 call at 5:52 a.m. By 5:55 a.m., help is on the way. At approximately 5:59 a.m., Officer Rick French of the Boulder Police Department is the first cop in uniform to arrive on the scene. We don't know what occurred inside the home in the short window between Patsy hanging up on 911 dispatcher Kim Archuleta and when Rick French arrived at the front door. So I'm going to read directly from the report made by Officer Rick French, specifically the first page where he documents what initially occurs. I responded to 755 15th Street in the city and county of Boulder, Colorado at approximately 0555 hours on the 26th of December 1996 on a report of a possible kidnapping. Upon arrival, I met with a distraught Patricia Ramsey and her husband John. John advised me that their 6-year-old daughter JonBenet was missing and that their 9-year-old son Burke was asleep upstairs. John directed me through the house and pointed out a 3-page handwritten note which was laid on the wooden floor just west of the kitchen area. He told me that his wife had found the note on the bottom step of a spiral staircase which led to the upper levels of the house. I'm uncertain about who moved the note. The note advised the Ramseys that their daughter was in the possession of a group of suspects and demanded a ransom of $118,000 to be delivered by a means detailed to them later in a subsequent telephone call. I spoke with Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey while Burke continued to sleep. Mrs. Ramsey told me that she had gone into JonBenet's room at about 0545 hours to wake her in preparation for a short trip the family was to take later that day. She found JonBenet's room empty and then discovered the note as she walked down the stairs. She immediately called the police. A quick inspection of the interior of the house, as well as talking to Mr. Ramsey, indicated that there was no obvious sign of a forced entry or struggle. Mr. Ramsey told me that the house appeared to be locked up as it had been left. The Ramseys have an alarm system inside of the house which was not engaged, as is normal for them. They have a small dog, but he had spent the night with a neighbor across the street, which is also normal. Both Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey stated they had not heard anything unusual during the night. As there was no initial refuting evidence, I advised Sergeant Reichenbach that it was possibly an actual kidnapping, and we proceeded to control the scene as such, with Sergeant Reichenbach paging advocates, detectives, and crime scene investigators. Okay, so the first thing I want to address is the first inconsistency between what Patsy told Rick French happened that morning and what she later told investigators when questioned again. According to French, Patsy said she went into JonBenet's room that morning, saw her daughter was missing from the room, and then proceeded to go downstairs and find the ransom note on the bottom step of the spiral staircase leading to the area outside the kitchen. At that point, she called 911. However, in later iterations of the story, Patsy says she went downstairs to make coffee, saw the ransom note on the bottom step of the spiral staircase, and upon realizing what it was by reading it, she went back upstairs to find JonBenet missing from her room, at which point John checked on Burke as she alerted John to what was occurring. John supposedly sat on the floor in his underwear and read the note when he came down, which is how it reportedly moved from the bottom step, although Patsy could have initially moved it when she found it, and it was simply already there on the floor once John arrived. So, after French reads the note, he proceeds to do a search of the home. However, he makes a couple of critical errors in the process, and likely because, as he mentioned, this was a quick inspection of the home, and the home happens to be very large. It's also dark at the time. JonBenet had a balcony attached to her second floor bedroom with a door leading to and from it, which would clearly be a point of entry for a prospective kidnapper. French, unfortunately, makes no mention of whether that door was locked or unlocked, as he was operating in the context of trying to establish the presence of forced entry, which I find really strange, considering his report even verifies that he knew the Ramseys didn't have their alarm system engaged that night. Of course, as we discussed in the last episode, they suggested that their dog had been staying at a neighbor's home, and that was normal. So we know the animal would not have been able to bark at an intruder. It's not like the dog was having a sleepover at a friend's house. They essentially got rid of the animal while retaining rights for JonBenet to make frequent visits to play with him. So not checking to see if the balcony door was locked or unlocked would be the first error. Secondly, French made no mention of the broken window in the basement, which would later become the backbone of the intruder theory, suggesting that a kidnapper would have made his way through that window upon entry, and also when he fled. What's also interesting is that John Ramsey, who claimed to be the one who broke that window months earlier when he got locked out one day, had actually not spoken a word about the window to French either. And to complete a trifecta of critical mistakes here in this search, Officer French declines to open the wine cellar door in the basement, behind which JonBenet's dead body rested inside a white blanket. He claims he did not enter the wine cellar because he was searching for a point of entry and exit for the perpetrator, including signs of forced entry. But if that's the case, why did he not see the large broken window in the train room down there and inquire about how it might have happened? Furthermore, why did John Ramsey not mention it initially? I really don't know. Now, what bothers me about this search is that the purpose should not be singular in the sense of searching for signs of forced entry. One pertinent aspect of establishing a kidnapping narrative, which should go without saying, is to confirm that the child is no longer in the home. No, the wine cellar did not offer a means of entry and exit as it pertains to the kidnapper coming and going from the house. But in terms of a child being concealed, there was no location within the home more suitable to the task. The wine cellar was pitch black, as it had no windows or exterior door. A child could easily hide, or be hidden, in a place like that, and if we examine the psychology of why the body would be left there, it would be the same, in the sense that this room offers greater concealment than any other. Now, returning to an earlier point made in a previous episode, like the Ramseys, French seems to disregard the strongly conveyed idea by the kidnapper that JonBenet is going to be executed by way of beheading if the family calls the police. Obviously, they should get law enforcement involved, but at this point, as his own patrol car is parked outside the home, in a situation in which it says the kidnapper is monitoring the Ramseys' behavior to be sure they don't talk to the police, Rick French reports that they used absolutely no discretion. The report states that he contacted Sergeant Reichenbach to suggest this could be an actual kidnapping, which led to Reichenbach paging detectives, CSI, and even victims' advocates in an effort to quote-unquote control the scene. Contrary to that assertion, what is actually happening is that they are going to contaminate the crime scene and spark what will soon be a national media circus outside the home, while ignoring any type of discretion that might keep the child alive, if in fact she has actually been kidnapped from the house. So regardless which side of the fence you're on, in terms of an intruder or a cover-up, it's apparent that the Boulder Police Department failed to properly handle this developing situation, likely due to inexperience. Yet what's fascinating about that reality is that they were inexperienced due to these types of things very rarely occurring, if at all, under their jurisdiction. In fact, JonBenet Ramsey's murder was the only murder to occur in Boulder, Colorado in 1996. And given that this crime scene is very controversial due to the presence of evidence suggesting it might have been staged, the reasoning stands, especially in light of the kidnapped child never having left the house. Now, let's delve into the ransom note itself and try to unearth the truth within it. I'll read it from start to finish. The note's nearly 3 notebook pages long. It was written on a legal pad and done so with a black Sharpie. Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence an earlier pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for a proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you to not provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John. Victory. SBTC. Okay, so first off, the ransom note was written on what amounted to nearly 3 pages of notebook paper that matched a legal pad Patsy Ramsey kept nearby to make notes. It was by the same phone she used to make the 911 call, indicating that this legal pad was regularly used to make notes pertaining to information from phone calls she made. In the pre-smartphone era, this was a common practice, and so both paper and writing implements, such as pencils or pens, and even the Sharpie, would have been readily available in this location of the home, which could explain why the ransom note would be left adjacent to it at the bottom of the spiral staircase. The pages, of course, were removed from the legal pad, and according to Patsy, were laid out individually across the bottom step, meaning 3 in a row from start to finish, rather than being stacked upon one another. Now, as detectives later learned with a great deal of certainty, there wasn't just a match between the paper the author used and the paper Patsy kept by the phone. In fact, her legal pad itself was proven to have been the source of the paper, and furthermore, the note had been written on it before the pages were removed and placed on the bottom step of the staircase. At first, investigators were not aware of these facts, but while searching the immediate area for clues and realizing the legal pad paper matched the ransom note paper, they flipped through the notepad and made a crucial discovery. it was revealed that the author of the ransom note had actually composed multiple practice notes before settling on the version left on the staircase nearby. While we don't know the entirety of what was contained in those practice notes, we are aware of a few distinctive differences. The first is that one practice note addressed its audience with "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey," rather than the final version only addressed to Mr. Ramsey. One of the practice notes also suggested that the foreign faction who kidnapped JonBenet did not respect John Ramsey's business, while the final version contradicted that notion by claiming that they did in fact respect John's business, but did not respect the country that it serves. The Ramseys claimed to have no knowledge of the practice notes, meaning they would not have known about one of them addressing both parents in the form of Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey. But when John Ramsey was questioned about the final ransom note he read, he quoted it as being addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey. Anyhow, let's delve into the content, beginning with that consideration of how the note is addressed. The text begins by simply addressing Mr. Ramsey, followed by a comma, and then the main text lies below that in what we would consider to be a letter. Now, we have very few communications of this sort on a personal level in this day and age, but in matters of formality, such as a mailed letter from a business or even a similar email, we still use this formal approach. But why here? This is a ransom note left inside the home of a kidnapped little girl, so there's very little need for such formality and pretense. Formality is simply not necessary. Clarification of the recipient isn't necessary. And the same thing goes for niceties we consider polite, such as addressing people by name. Ransom notes are normally short, direct, and lacking extensive nuances. They're like that for good reason. If you have already kidnapped someone's child and are now demanding ransom, there is no need to assert how serious you are about your intentions or the fact that the child is in danger, or even that this note is for the parents. All of those intentions are already implied by having used physicality as a means of taking what is theirs and making it vanish. A kidnapping for ransom is almost like a symbolic death in which the kidnapper previews what will be a permanent reality by foreshadowing with one that is temporary. You have lost a child, one who isn't coming back, unless you provide something the kidnapper believes is of equal value. So traditionally, actions speak louder than words, and of the few words that need to be spoken, or even written, none of them needs to include a series of threats directed at proving that you are, in fact, serious. So, we see a strong degree of formality here in the sense that the letter is properly addressed according to the standards of letter writing, and that the term note that is often used to define the ransom demand is, to a greater or lesser extent, incorrect. This is not a ransom note. Most demands for ransom do consist of short notes. However, this communication will prove to be a lengthy letter, one supported by a formal opening addressed to a specific recipient, which will be followed by properly indented paragraphs that, for the most part, hold true to starting a new paragraph with each new subject in the letter. The letter consists of three paragraphs, with the latter two being exceptionally lengthy. Yet what we see by the end is that it also contains a closing consistent with a letter in the sense that, below the text, it tells us who the letter is from, even if the author chooses to remain somewhat anonymous with a cryptic signature of SBTC. So, we have a formally written, lengthy letter being disguised as a ransom note, when in truth, any such ransom note would need to be no longer than the following. We have your daughter. We want $118,000. We'll call to arrange a drop-off. If you want to see her again, don't involve the police. Convincing a reader that you are indeed serious about your intentions is worthless when you have already proven exactly what you will do by way of your actions. No kidnapper who actually has your child in his possession actually sits around writing practice notes as he ponders what would be the perfect way to make sure you know he's actually serious. Believe me, anyone who breaks into your house at night and rips your 6-year-old child from her bed and holds her hostage is serious. If you have the audacity to do such a thing and have followed through, then you will absolutely not be insecure about anyone believing your intentions are real. You've already proven they are. When the proof is in the pudding, as they say, we don't have to convince anyone of anything. We only have to provide the details that aren't apparent. So if you wake up and your kid is gone and the kidnapper expects a ransom in exchange for getting her back, one in which he obviously doesn't want the police to be involved, then the only information to convey at that point is when, where, how, and of course, how much. The extensive use of words is used to try to prove something in the absence of definitive proof, and in the form of convincing, when we cannot factually convey something through action. Here, if JonBenet had actually been kidnapped by someone who took her outside the home, nobody writing that letter would need to ramble on and on in such a fashion. But they do. And we subsequently learn that she has not actually been kidnapped and, of course, is not outside the home and, furthermore, is not even alive. So in that circumstance, one would be inclined to try to convince others. Yet if you're the killer, you don't need any form of deception because you entered and fled the home without being detected. No one knows who you are. You don't need to misdirect the police or family. You just leave. But if you were responsible for this result and still inside the house, then that is the circumstance that would drive the desperation to convince the reader. Okay, so sticking to that aspect of addressing Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey in the practice note before switching to Mr. Ramsey in the final version, we have to ask why. Well, in my estimation, we have a very simple consideration here. While there are many women who are great leaders of everything from businesses to countries and so on, our evolutionary trajectory has been one in which violence preceded civilization, and therefore a long history of men leading the way, as men are generally bigger, stronger, and more predisposed to both athletic and predatory pursuits such as hunting and warfare. So if a group of women is asked about the most attractive characteristic a man can possess, undoubtedly, the consensus among those polled will be one specific thing: confidence. Women generally love to see a strong sense of confidence in a man, and for a specific reason, which is that confidence is the foremost of the key ingredients in becoming a good leader, as confidence is necessary for overcoming adverse conditions. From the standpoint of character-related qualities, men who lead with confidence are the most attractive because those attributes precipitate success, whether romantic, financial, or otherwise. So here, the author of the practice note initially addresses it to Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, but later changes course to only direct it to the attention of Mr. Ramsey. On a subconscious level, this person who wrote this note, or letter, is suggesting that John Ramsey should be at the forefront of the adversity, the focus of the fallout, while Mrs. Ramsey should take a back seat, even to the extent of having her name eradicated from the document. Now, what this suggests is that the author is someone who resides in a more traditional role in that regard, meaning a woman who is not necessarily a leader. The point is to focus on John as the leader and the one who can not only handle but overcome this adversity in a similar sense of going to war to fight a battle. So, the author is coming from more of a submissive or subservient disposition, if you will, and recognizes John to be the leader. This person thought better about placing Mrs. Ramsay in that role alongside her husband and has now instead insisted John leads the way. Now, ask yourself, who would want John Ramsay to lead the way? Who has the staunch belief that he is confident and a successful leader while thinking of herself as someone who shouldn't be on the front lines like that? Well, that was Patsy Ramsay's relationship to John in their marriage. Patsy was a stay-at-home mom, a caregiver to their children, someone who made a home, while her confident, successful husband went off to work every day to lead a company and provide for them, which is the modern or civilized version of what used to be hunting and going to war. In the changing of Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay to Mr. Ramsay upon having second thoughts, the writer concedes John Ramsay as the dominant partner. In times of trouble within a marriage, we lean on a partner's best qualities. In that light, John would be best suited for the front lines of a business deal, even if it's a ransom exchange, because he's a leader in business. On the other hand, Patsy Ramsay earned a bachelor's degree from West Virginia University in 1978 with a major in journalism. She's a writer. Here, in this text, we have a formally written letter disguised as a ransom note, while the content of the business exchange within is directed toward John. So let's get into the body of the letter now. The first line directs John to listen carefully, with an exclamation point. Again, such a demand is redundant in the context of someone already having kidnapped your daughter. Trust me, if you find your 6-year-old missing from her bed in the morning and a ransom note is left in the kidnapper's wake, you will have the parents' attention. This kidnapping / sexual assault / murder is one deemed to have been perpetrated by a man. Yet no man who has just forcefully kidnapped a small child believes he needs to scold you with the words, "listen carefully," followed by an exclamation point. If someone does this to your child, you understand in no uncertain terms that he is deadly serious. However, here, we have what amounts to a mother scolding a child who won't behave or do what she wants. It's an insinuation that the recipient of the letter is reluctant or unwilling to listen and must receive a stern warning that there will be consequences if he fails to comply with the demand. That is not how a violent man behaves. It's what a mother says to a child. And so it's no surprise that we'll see this maternal tone continue. The next line is this: we are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. First off, let me assure you that absolutely no violent man seeking a position of power or dominance is going to describe himself or any group he represents as small, as it contradicts the potency of the threats. People who commit violent crimes, such as murders, kidnappings, and sexual assaults, distance themselves from any notion of impotence or lack of size and power, as what has actually driven them to commit such crimes is truly a feeling of powerlessness they can't deal with emotionally in a way that it can be overcome. So the urge to defy it manifests physically. Beyond that, we have the assertion that the offenders are a group of individuals, which sounds awfully strange. Why not just say we are a group that represents a small foreign faction? Well, the answer here is also fairly accessible, given the result of the crime. Again, we have an incoherent dual narrative involved with this child's death, at least in terms of appearances, with one narrative claiming a kidnapping in writing, while the physical trail speaks to a sexual crime ending in murder. The crime, as it plays out in physicality, in the form of a sadistic sexual assault followed by murder, is typical of something committed by a sole perpetrator and not a group. While pedophile rings certainly do exist, and even human trafficking in which children are assaulted by staggering numbers of people over the course of time, a domestic crime in which a perpetrator enters the home to bind, torture, and murder a victim is most often the result of one offender. On the other hand, criminal factions or groups often perpetrate kidnappings, and even in circumstances in which only a few members, or even one, does the deed. Whomever wrote the note knows that both the kidnapping narrative and the sexual assault leading to murder narrative are present here, and so, using the strange term, group of individuals, they accommodate both. Now, this group of individuals is not specifically stated as being members of the small foreign faction. Rather, they're designated as representatives. Now, when we convey negative and unwelcome ideas that exist emotionally in our minds into physicality, we often mirror or reverse them, which symbolically turns a negative into a positive. Of course, the reverse is true as well. If something occurs in physicality, or on the canvas of reality, so to speak, we often mirror or reverse it to the same effect. So here, the main ideas we have are that the kidnappers are not members of the group, but only representing them, and that they are indeed foreign. Now, what are John and Patsy Ramsey? They are members of the family, and not just representing them. And also domestic, meaning in their home, or you could say, not foreign to it. What I see here is an attempt to displace blame onto a faceless entity outside the home, or foreign to it, rather than the people inside. Think about the body language of people. It works the same way. If two people are attracted to each other, whether romantically or by way of agreement, or similarity, they often indulge what is called mirroring, a subconscious practice in which they project their own body language onto each other in order to achieve a symbiosis that matches their emotions. It's a symbolic gesture of something fractured, meaning two separate elements, coming together or becoming whole as one. It portrays an unspoken truth. Yet when the context is negative and a disagreement or lack of attraction is present, that mirroring occurs in the sense of a reversal. If one person is attracted to the other or seeking to let someone inside, that might be represented by body language such as open arms that expose the chest, where the heart lies, which represents our emotional world in the context of love. But if the opposite side receives this negatively or disagrees, the second person might respond with crossed arms, thereby protecting the chest, or you could say, failing to expose the heart. Mirroring in a positive manner heals the fracture of two things to become one, or whole, while mirroring emotionally with the intention of negativity manifests a physical reversal, keeping two elements fractured or in a state of disagreement in which nothing heals or becomes whole. That result exists as a measure of our binary nature, meaning body and mind. We live in a constant state of disunity between the two, seeking to achieve healing or harmony to our fractured state by becoming whole. So, again, that is why manual strangulation accounts for so many murders that involve men killing women after being rejected. The man feels emotional disunity between body and mind, and as we just spoke about, proceeds to mirror that negativity in a physical context by literally using his hands to cut off the connection between her body and mind, leading to a physical death he believes brings unity to the emotional one he suffered. Moving along, the next line reads, "We respect your business, but not the country that it serves." Now let's recall that one of the practice ransom notes, to the contrary, states, "We don't respect your business." So why did the author of the ransom note have a change of heart? Well, let's think about this for a moment. Imagine that you and I are business associates of John Ramsey, and we learn that his young daughter has been kidnapped by an intruder. Certainly, we would feel a great deal of empathy and might even offer to help, or at least offer words of comfort in the family's troubling time. If we learn the motive was to damage or embarrass your country in some way and not your business in which we're actually interested, then our empathy probably has no bounds. However, business is still business, so let's look at the alternative. Imagine instead that the final version of the ransom note says, "We don't respect your business," that those words were never discarded, and on the news we're learning, along with the entire nation and even the world, that it seems your business was being targeted and was the reason for the kidnapping rather than the country it served. That changes things a great deal. That business, as the target of a foreign entity, one willing to indulge violence, and is likely capable of much greater damage than a single kidnapping, is a huge liability, and in no uncertain terms, is a sign to cut ties with John right now. Even after changing the wording in that note, John's business prospects and financial potency were virtually destroyed, leaving him all but broke. He became an enormous liability due to the negativity of the publicity associated with this case, and specifically due to its controversial nature. Had his daughter definitively been proven to have been kidnapped and/or murdered by an intruder, he would have avoided disaster. And so, in the wording of this ransom note, the fear and anxiety about how this will affect his future business prospects is more than apparent. Ask yourself who is more likely to change that wording. A kidnapper with nothing to lose if John Ramsey suffers the fallout of this crime? Or the Ramseys themselves? Okay, so here's the closing of the first of three paragraphs. "At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter." Now, instead of seeking the subtext of what's written here, let's first consider the reality. In retrospect, we know the JonBenet is not in the possession of a foreign faction. Truthfully, she's still in the Ramsey's basement. That's followed by an assertion that she's safe and unharmed. Of course, contrary to that assertion, she's already dead. But here's where we need to go back and read those lines again, as most people miss the desperation to convince the reader. Think of when someone accuses you of doing something wrong, and you deny it. When they refuse to believe you, what is your first inclination as to what you should do to convince them? Normally, you would repeat yourself, or repeat the denial. So if someone asks, "Did you do this or that?" and you say no, and they remain unconvinced, you might immediately reply by saying, "I didn't," or "No, I didn't." You might be able to prove it through some means in the aftermath, or maybe not because you're lying, but your first inclination is redundancy in the form of repeating yourself in an effort to convince the other person. So now, let's look at those lines again. "At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter." That first line could just be this: "We have your daughter." It implies both currency, as it's the present tense, and also possession. However, the line is hyperextended for repetition and redundancy to read, "At this time, we have your daughter in our possession." It doubles down on both the aspects of time, meaning right now or the present, as well as possession. Yet what do we know is true? They don't have her. Thus, the inclination by the writer to convince us otherwise, as the author knows, is simply a lie. Then the next line. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. Again, notice the redundancy present in the phrase safe and unharmed, which are one and the same, and how that redundancy is used as a measure of convincing us of something we know to be a lie in retrospect. She is absolutely not safe or unharmed, and sure as hell not going to be alive in 1997. Now, let's look at the last clause of that final line of the paragraph, which reads, "You must follow our instructions to the letter." That line could simply be, "You must follow our instructions." But once again, the author doubles down on the idea by both saying you must follow our instructions and its modification of to the letter, which does nothing to actually modify the meaning. It's redundant. Of course, if JonBenet is already dead and the parents intend to disregard the instructions in the letter, as we know is going to be revealed, this serves to justify a predetermined result. They are trying to convince. This is where the second paragraph begins. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. Let's address the amount first. John Ramsey started a company called Advanced Product Group in 1989, and by 1991 he merged that company with two others, at which point they became known as Access Graphics, which was a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. By Christmas 1996, at the time of JonBenet's murder, John's and Patsy's assets were estimated to be worth nearly $7.5 million, while John's net worth was estimated at closer to $6.5 million at the time. Adjusted for inflation, $6.5 million in 1996 would amount to approximately $12.5 million in today's dollar. John was definitely on the verge of getting even wealthier, as he had just been named Boulder's Entrepreneur of the Year for 1996 and earned that distinction as a result of Access Graphics grossing over $1 billion that year. So what makes the amount demanded in the ransom note interesting is twofold. The first consideration is that $118,000 was the amount of John's bonus that year, which he had just recently received. In terms of subtext, this request seems to infer that someone familiar with John's income, specifically an insider at the company, was involved in the kidnapping of his daughter, whether directly or by way of an association with those who perpetrated the crime. However, it has never been substantiated in any way, shape, or form that someone from within Access Graphics was guilty of such a thing. To the contrary, if we indulge Occam's razor for a moment, it isn't difficult to understand that the two parties we know for a fact had prior knowledge of John's bonus amount were the person who wrote the check and the one who cashed it. In that light, the Ramseys themselves were at least as likely, if not more, than any other party to have chosen that sum. What we also understand is that this amount is little more than pocket change for a man of John's rising stature, and the kidnapper or the foreign faction easily could have asked for far more money than they did. Why not at least half a million, or even $2 million? Why lowball with high risk, especially when you are a group of people? this money has to be spread around. What I see here is a subconscious choice to select an amount that would seem substantial to most who read the note, but still fall within a modest range at which the loss wouldn't harm the Ramsey's finances. As we'll see later in the note, the kidnapper claims to have chosen John because he was a fat cat, which is a derogatory term for a wealthy man. So if they selected him due to his wealth, why are they asking for so little? The author of this note seems concerned about loss, as the number is conservative, and since we're talking about withdrawing actual cash, this person writing the note seems intent upon limiting loss. Once that $118,000 cash has been withdrawn from the bank and utilized in the context of this case, it could potentially be seized by the police or withheld for whatever reason. So once the Ramseys have removed it from the bank, they know there is risk involved, and likely that is the reason we have such a small amount. That's just not how somebody desperate enough to seek a ransom thinks. And with the amount matching John's bonus, the possibility for who committed the crime is limited to a very select group. Even if John's bonus as president and CEO was made public, those earnings would not have been made public by that time, as the final quarter of 1996 was not even over. And to put an exclamation point on an idea we discussed earlier, JonBenet Ramsey's murder was the only murder in Boulder, Colorado that year of 1996. The kidnapper also requests $100,000 in $100 bills and $18,000 in $20 bills. This isn't how people in desperate need of money think. To the contrary, this is generally how wealthy people think, as $100 bills allow you to carry a large amount of money without being in possession of an excessive amount of cash, yet keeping some small bills on hand also allows for everyday purchases, so to speak, where hundreds often can't be cashed, such as when you get gas for your vehicle or buy something at a convenience store. This kidnapper's thinking in a practical manner rather than indulging the greatest efficiency. For that reason, it doesn't surprise me that the next line gives off maternal vibes in a way that simply cannot be ignored, as the kidnapper tells the Ramseys to quote-unquote, make sure you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. It sounds like your mother reminding you to wear a coat today because it's cold. Beyond that, attaché is a very sophisticated word for someone who, earlier in the note, misspelled the word business. The author even accentuated the word attaché in the proper place. For anyone who is unfamiliar, an attaché is essentially a briefcase. There are sometimes minor differences between them, and other times they are one and the same, or interchangeable. So thematically, we see a continuing maternal tone in the note, one that is based in practicality. The author then goes on to tell the Ramseys that they should place the money in a brown paper bag when they get home. The next line is, I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. First of all, this note claims the Ramseys are being watched, and yet, when the time comes to receive this call, they're going to have a house full of cops who are parked outside and also cops around the perimeter of the home, all while having a recording device set up on their landline in an effort to trace the kidnapper's call when it comes. Meanwhile, the kidnapper says they'll kill the girl if the police get involved. Yet, here they are, preparing to take that very call, knowing they disobeyed. Now, the real controversy comes here in the form of wondering what the kidnapper means by tomorrow. Nobody seems to know exactly when the note was written. It could have been written before midnight, but after the Ramseys allegedly went to bed on Christmas night. Or it could have been written in the middle of the night, on the 26th or in the early morning hours of the 26th, which would technically already be the next day. So ultimately, nobody seemed to know what tomorrow meant. It could have meant the 26th if the note was written the night of the 25th, but if it was written in the early morning hours of the 26th, then it might have been suggesting the 27th. Sometimes when people are awake late into the night and have not yet gone to bed, but the clock has passed midnight, they still consider it the same day. So while tomorrow could have meant the 27th for somebody writing a note in the middle of the night, it also could have been intended for the 26th. Either way, it didn't matter because the call never came. Here's where the kidnapper reverts to a maternal instinct once again. The person writes in relation to delivering the ransom money to the kidnappers, "The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested." So many aspects of this note display authority in the tone of a mother speaking to a child and not a violent man making uncompromising demands without any concern for things that don't benefit him in some way. Why on earth would the kidnapper be concerned with how well the Ramses slept before bringing him his money? Why does he have empathy for their well-being in a situation in which he's threatening to behead their young child? Now, if we read into the subtext of the kidnapper's assertion that the delivery will be exhausting, what we notice is that there are generally two elements that make something exhausting. One is an excessive amount of time spent doing it, and the other is the difficulty of the activities in that time frame. So the elements being conveyed here are that the kidnapper, and thus JonBenet, are in a place that is both far away, meaning it takes a long time to get there, and difficult to get to, meaning it will be a great effort to arrive in their destination. But again, remember what we just talked about regarding mirroring in a negative context. If the kidnapper suggests it will be an exhaustive trip to get to the delivery spot and recover their daughter, taking a long time and a great deal of effort, we understand that the mirrored projection of that is that JonBenet is not far away and it will actually take very little effort to recover her. And what is true is that she is both very close, meaning the basement, and it will take only seconds to descend the stairs to get to her, requiring very little effort. These are the next few lines of the note. "If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence an earlier pickup of your daughter." Okay, so right here is where the third and final indented paragraph of the letter begins. It's also the longest section. "Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for a proper burial." Why is the kidnapper non-committal to his own time frame and simply playing it by ear based on what the Ramses do? That's not how you dictate terms. You have the leverage by having the hostage. You hold the power. But here the kidnapper is willing to concede his own plans based upon the Ramses spontaneously deciding they want to do something different. And this flexibility on the kidnapper's part comes literally right after he just specified that his instructions must be followed to the letter. He writes that any deviation of his instructions will result in JonBenet's immediate execution. Why would he be so adamant about that and then put the ball in their court, allowing them to choose when they get the money and causing the kidnapper to deviate from his stated plan of calling between 8 and 10 a.m.? Well, when it comes to the time the kidnapper is going to call, as we already discussed, whatever time is chosen by the writer of the note will be false, as JonBenet is already dead. So the only party involved in this exchange who still has something at stake is the Ramses. If the call truly has no specific time frame, then there is no expectation it will truly come at any specific moment, and the longer the narrative can be played out. In this case, the waiting can simply continue without suspicions being raised. Now, what would the Ramses gain in this scenario? Well, if they know the body is in the basement wine cellar, but has yet to be found, then the kidnapping narrative remains valid as the police will still await the call. The killer then amends the threat of execution by stating that their daughter's remains will not be returned to allow a proper burial. In cases in which a violent sexual sadist murders your young daughter, just about the last consideration that killer would ever have is returning the body for a proper burial. Victims usually find themselves buried in the middle of nowhere, tossed in a dumpster, thrown down a hill alongside a highway, dropped off a bridge into a river, or worse. The notion of returning a body for a proper burial speaks to a degree of empathy most sociopaths and psychopaths almost never exhibit. And again, here we have that mirrored reversal of a negative value in the sense that the Ramses are going to have JonBenet's body returned to them and she is going to have a proper burial, despite the kidnapper stating the opposite as a result of deviating from plans and contacting cops. The author continues with, "The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you to not provoke them." Now, why is the author specifying the number of people watching over JonBenet and making specific mention of not provoking them? Who are these two gentlemen? Well, obviously, we know JonBenet was already dead, and the two men mentioned as watching over her somewhere outside the home is not a literal statement, as it would be impossible. Rather, it's somewhat of a metaphorically derived interpretation of where she is now in death, meaning at the time of the letter being written. The number two describing the gentleman, along with the term watch over, suggesting it's happening from above, when combined with the fact that the Ramses, and especially Patsy, being devout Christians, lends itself to the notion of the two gentlemen watching over JonBenet in a place outside the home as being God and Jesus in heaven. There's a well-known Bible verse that reads like this, "The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore." Now, why would the letter suggest that the two gentlemen in this duo do not particularly like John Ramsey? Well, Patsy Ramsey was known to be far more spiritual and committed to her faith than her husband John, who described himself as someone who thought of attending church as a chore, and said that he had only been a Christian by default of being born in Nebraska. He suggested his participation had more to do with the religion being a product of his upbringing and cultural ties rather than a product of his faith. So Patsy clearly would have considered herself a better and more loyal Christian, so to speak, someone who walked the walk while her husband John merely talked the talk by going through the motions. And here we have a letter suspected to be written by Patsy and directed in its address to John Ramsey specifically, in which the author suggests that the two gentlemen, so to speak, watching over JonBenet, do not particularly like John, so he shouldn't provoke them. It seems to be a thinly veiled attack on John's lack of faith, suggesting that he should fear the provocation of the two gentlemen, aka Jesus and God, watching over his daughter now in heaven, or there will be consequences. The author of the note, in the subtext, is essentially begging John to indulge a stronger and more meaningful sense of Christian faith in an effort at achieving forgiveness, which the author seems to believe is necessary in order to negate the potential wrath of the two gentlemen, Jesus and God, watching over their daughter in heaven. What the author intends to say is that if John wants to be reunited with his daughter in heaven, he must afford himself strict adherence to the rules of faith that will guide him. Accordingly, John Ramsay's faith actually grew as he was forced to lean into it for strength, as this ordeal the family endured tested him like never before. Now, coming down the home stretch of this letter, the elephant in the room for the writer, regardless of whether it's an actual intruder or a family member indulging a cover-up, is that JonBenet is already dead. So here is where the writer will attempt to make death a consequence that seemingly could not possibly be avoided given the circumstances to follow. It states, speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John. Victory. SBTC. So, in relation to the beheading, the Ramsays ignored the threat and demanded the police come to their home without providing any type of warning to be discreet. Why? Is your daughter being decapitated not strong enough motivation to at least attempt to move forward discreetly? Then we have the line, if we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. Many people have pointed out that this line, among others in the note, is quite similar to lines spoken in the early 1970s film Dirty Harry, who is a cop played by Clint Eastwood. Yet none of them are written verbatim in the note or even closely enough to confirm that they were intentionally copied from the films. The same goes for other lines being attributed to other well-known movies of the eras preceding JonBenet's death. The multiple lines I just read that end with the threat she dies are similar to those spoken in the 1980s film Ruthless People. On top of that, we have the line that reads, "Don't try to grow a brain, John." Dennis Hopper, who plays the villain in the 1994 film Speed starring Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves, uses the taunt, "Do not attempt to grow a brain." So with more than a dozen total instances of similarities between movie lines and the note, what's being conveyed by their inclusion? Are they intentional as a means of dark humor, or is there something else at play? Well, I would guess that some of them are intentional, and others are simply coincidental because they are common forms of expression in similar situations requiring the same sort of demands. However, at the root of these occurrences, I think the strongest motivating factor for including them, whether intentional or unintentional, is that the person writing the ransom note has no experience as a criminal or even being the villain, but was suddenly cast in a role for which she had no prior experience, one in which she would be acting from that point on. And the only thing on which she could rely to accommodate is what she had learned and remembered from watching movies involving villains. Dirty Harry, while a serious film, is notoriously over the top in its presentation. Ruthless People, while it dealt directly with a kidnapping, was actually an outrageous comedy. And Speed, while it was also thrilling and at times serious with its high stakes of life or death, was afforded a very dark sense of humor in its narrative by way of Dennis Hopper in the role of the villain. Now let's look at the next lines here. "Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John." They don't play to me as a kidnapper taunting a vulnerable father who wants his daughter back. Instead, what I see is one last plea at the end of the letter from a wife to her husband, as she is about to complete her duties as writer, aka journalism major, and then hand this operation off to John, who will take the lead from there. According to people who knew the couple, Patsy had often joked about John's good Southern common sense in the past, as John was not actually a Southerner, but often was mistaken for one because Patsy was. John was born in Nebraska before moving on to Michigan, and only later moved to Atlanta with Patsy. Now, the final lines play to me like a desperate plea to fire up her man and call on him to lead the way through the adversity ahead. Nearly all of that last paragraph of the note is redundant and unnecessary, and even stoops to what could be construed as cheerleading at the end as she hands the baton off to her husband to take the lead in bringing them down the home stretch to safety. And then we have the signature at the end. It reads "Victory" with an exclamation point followed by SBTC. In Christianity, the word victory or achievement of victory is used in the context of victory over death, or more specifically, the resurrection of Christ as being indicative of victory over death, not in a physical context, but spiritually. By extension, believers of this victory are promised their own victory upon death, as they are afforded spiritual ascension to the heavens, mimicking the death and subsequent resurrection of Jesus. And so, what I think the author is concluding with here is an assertion that JonBenet has achieved this victory and, like the Savior Jesus, has been saved on a spiritual level. Therefore, the most commonly attributed translation of the abbreviation SBTC that follows the word victory probably applies here, meaning saved by the cross, which represents the crucifixion of Jesus that led to the miracle in which he was resurrected. And if the person writing the letter believes this, then that person is also well aware that JonBenet is already dead at the time of writing the note. So, we have a maternal tone present throughout the note, one that gives way to threats less consistent with truly violent people, and more so consistent with someone pretending to be that type of person without experience, like an actor, and relying on other actors from memory to learn the ropes. We also see a strong sense of Christian faith, and someone calling upon John Ramsey to step up his game and lead them to where they must go. While I respect the opinion of others as equal to my own, I simply cannot envision a scenario in which the author of this phony ransom note is anybody other than Patsy Ramsey. The profile matches her very well. JonBenet's name was not present in her frantic call to 911, nor is it present in the ransom note, despite the little girl being the subject of both communications. Many people close to the Ramseys, along with the Ramseys themselves, were asked to submit handwriting samples to be matched against the ransom note. The only person authorities could not rule out from among the group as the author of the note was none other than Patsy Ramsey. When handwriting analyst Chet Yubowski of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation was shown a sample of Patsy's writing compare it against the style used in the ransom note, he concluded, quote, "This handwriting showed indications that the writer was Patsy Ramsey," end quote. Patsy also changed her handwriting on multiple occasions, proving that she was willing to be deceptive in that effort. While the Ramseys countered with experts of their own to claim the opposite, the truth remains elusive, as it seems to be in every other aspect of this case. But if it's true that Patsy wrote the ransom note, it's a profoundly disturbing truth, because we're left to ask ourselves, regardless of how JonBenet actually died, why a mother would stage a cover-up of her daughter's death as being a kidnapping turned sexual assault gone wrong, one in which the little girl had to be strangled to death after receiving a devastating blow to the head that fractured the entire length of her skull. Clearly, one would only do that to protect something precious, or even someone precious, which we'll address in coming episodes. But for now, I think what resonates with me is that one way or another, whether JonBenet was kidnapped by a sexual deviant desirous of a beautiful child he'd seen perform in a talent show, or slain by a jealous sibling for being that popular and gorgeous counterpart who was the apple of their mother's eye, Patsy Ramsey played a dangerous game when introducing her daughter to what amounted to stardom at such a young age, portraying a woman when she was only a little girl, no more than 6 years old. Why would anyone do that, we wonder, as we criticize her for trying to live vicariously through a child when her own aspirations of the past as a beauty queen had ended? The answer is one you can only find if you're willing to have empathy, if you're willing to see the world through another person's eyes, rather than judge her actions and dismiss them as irresponsible. Most of us just think there was something wrong with her, because, in fact, there truly was. You might notice that nearly all of the photos you see online depicting JonBenet as a beauty queen were taken when she was between the ages of 4 and 6, meaning between 1994, when she was 4 years old, and her death at age 6 in December 1996. Starting at age 4, Patsy indulged her daughter in the strongest sense of vanity, dressing her up in revealing clothes seemingly suitable only for a grown woman, while also applying makeup that turned a little girl in what appeared to be a miniature woman, giving us the sense something was terribly wrong with her mindset as a mother, and setting the stage for a predator to become obsessed with the child beauty. JonBenet was featured in talent shows, parades, beauty pageants, and similar, and driven to succeed, to win, and certainly to an extent that there was something more than her own enjoyment or passion driving this behavior. And there was Patsy behind the scenes, a former beauty queen as Miss West Virginia, living vicariously through JonBenet's victories, pushing her daughter faster and harder to become a bigger star in her household, in the community, and even beyond, to the point we know it played a role in her death, leaving us to ask why she would do this to JonBenet. Why did she push so hard, so fast, and without a second thought that might have saved her daughter? The answer is that Patsy was already living on borrowed time. In 1994, Patsy learned she had stage 4 ovarian cancer and believed she was going to die. Thinking she had so little time left with both of her children, and wouldn't be around to see her daughter grow to be a beautiful young woman with interests similar to her own, Patsy was incredibly desirous of not missing that chance, and chose to accelerate the process of JonBenet's maturation in a way that was a corruption of her innocence, one that, as we understand now, played some type of a role in the events that led to her death, regardless of how it happened. It wasn't because Patsy was evil, or selfish, or uncaring. It was because she was a parent, one who was going to die. She didn't want to miss those things, and seeing JonBenet's potential, she pushed the little girl into womanhood well before her time, making her the popular, beautiful star Patsy had once aspired to be in her own life. It was her greatest desire to see this fantasy come to fruition, and it truly did happen. She got to see her daughter on stage, and even most often as a winner. That opportunity did not pass her by. It isn't a coincidence that JonBenet's rise to stardom coincided with the onset of Mom's cancer diagnosis in 1994. We could indict Patsy's character for taking these seemingly harmful actions and putting her young daughter at risk while sacrificing the girl's innocence and ultimately her life. Yet if we abandon our need to judge and our desire to be right and just, even for a moment in which we only see the world through the eyes of empathy, we are able to understand why. Time was running out for Patsy. Although she went into remission for the better part of a decade after her diagnosis and treatment, the cancer finally did kill her. And so, when I think of her as a mother, and not the perpetrator of her daughter's lost innocence, only then can I feel her pain. Because time is running out for all of us. And as it does, all of the things we hope for and dream about will die too. All of them rendered silent for eternity. But in this moment, in this time we have left, we can breathe, we can feel, and we can use whatever resources we have at our disposal to ensure that we never give up, that we never die on the inside emotionally while physically standing on our own two feet. And for better or worse, like Patsy Ramsey, we ask ourselves how to live in a world in which we're doomed to die, but more importantly, how to do it before we run out of time. The only way to succeed in this regard is to keep moving forward, no matter what. Yet when we do that, we learn that we've been running from something, that we're driven by it, and that it will eventually catch up. I think the thing that had been chasing Patsy finally caught up to her, and the rest of us understand that one day it will come for us too. But if there's one place where we can learn from her mistakes, it's in believing that we must live through others to find meaning, especially our children. We are meant to live for them rather than through them, because to live for them means that we're placing their needs ahead of our own, as they should be. Patsy put her needs ahead of JonBenet's and projected her desires onto the youthful look and innocence she would never know again in her own right. In some ways, we all do that. We wonder where the time went and yearn for those carefree days of innocence to return. But they don't. Age and illness had taken those things from Patsy, and she wanted to know what it was like to be young and beautiful again, a desire she manifested by projecting that imagery upon JonBenet. This doesn't happen when we fail to love our children. It happens when we neglect to love ourselves because of something we lost and can never have back. And therefore, that idea manifested in Patsy losing JonBenet, unable to get her back. in this life, no matter how hard we hold on to the past, we can never get back that which has been lost forever. So maybe, as we age, grow old, frail, and ill, while everything crumbles to dust, we should hold true to the wisdom that the only thing in our world that never truly dies, before we take our last breath and close our eyes to darkness, is love. And if we can see that truth, we will finally have the strength to let go.